back down and shut your trap. It's time for
Keeping it sports with them three.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Well, I'll need some beer.
Are you ready?
You have to ask me nicely.
Come on now, don't be bashful.
Are you ready,
Place for the best sports talk and news surrounding each league.
I can prove it with my usual flawless logic.
Hey man, this time I'm gonna do it my way.
What's your name again?
And now, here's your host, M3, Mike Rosansky.
Into a new year and try to get back to some form of normalcy. One thing, though, that remains normal, and this is unfortunate, is the gift that keeps on giving in the NFL. A gift that all of us hate. A gift that, quite frankly, they have become the equivalent of getting coal in our stockings at Christmas. And that is, of course, the NFL officials. Because each and every single week, it feels like the officials are doing something to negatively impact the game or make themselves look like the third team on the field in given games. It seems to always pop up in the games that are prime time, games where everyone's focus, everyone's attention is squarely on them. Of course, I'm talking about what happened last Saturday night in Dallas between the Cowboys and the Lions. A night where I should be coming in today talking about another dominant record-setting performance by CeeDee Lamb, where the Lions' defense had no answer for him. We're talking about how mistake-prone Jared Goff has become, how it's his fourth multi-turnover game in the last seven games, and whether you can really feel good about him being the Lions' quarterback going into this postseason, or does he still leave you with a lot of questions? We could talk about how the Cowboys have been a dominant home team, winning their 16th consecutive home game, have been blowing teams out, but the Lions' defense somewhat held serve. The Cowboys had been averaging near 40 points a game at home, and the Lions' defense was able to contain everything outside of CeeDee Lamb and gave the team a chance to win the game in the later stages of Saturday evening. But no. Of course, we're talking about officials. We're talking about the refs once again screwing things up. I give the Lions a lot of credit. The fact that, A, they were still in it, considering some of the mistakes Goff had made throughout the evening, and how great CeeDee Lamb had played. But I also respect the guts and the tenacity of Dan Campbell after the touchdown by Amon-Ra St. Brown to go for two, to say screw it. I know that there's only about 25 seconds left on the game clock, but we're going to go for this. We're going to take a shot here. And it looked like they had the game won. It looked like Detroit was going to be that team that came into AT&T Stadium and finally shut the Cowboys up. Finally were the ones that put that one in the loss column for Dallas after not losing a home game in nearly 2 years. But Brad Allen's officiating crew screwed this up. When Jared Goff completes what looked like it was the go-ahead and game-winning two-point conversion pass to Taylor Decker, an offensive lineman, but then you see he's ruled as an ineligible receiver. And you're looking, at first you're saying, did Taylor Decker not report? Did he come on the field, line up in a wide receiver or tight end position along the line of scrimmage and not report himself as an eligible player? Well, you watch the replay and you see that he walked right up to the official. He's right up there talking to Brad Allen. What else could he be saying at that? What is he saying? Oh, what's your New Year's Eve plans? No, of course he's up there telling him that he's an eligible receiver on this play, that they're going to do something kind of quirky. Hey, Dan Campbell told the officials before the game, if we have a chance at a two-point conversion, this is something that we're going to do. This is something we're going to try. Look for my guys to come up to you and tell them that they're an eligible receiver. Now, you can't have two players report as eligible receivers on the same play. But what clearly happened here is throughout the night, they had mostly been using Dan Skipper, who was a backup offensive lineman for the Lions, as the eligible receiver, saying, oh, 70 is eligible. And Skipper, you see him in this, he kind of go walking up alongside Taylor Decker to deceive the defense, to show the Cowboys that, oh, there's going to be something a little bit weird here, but them defensively not knowing who it is until the official makes the announcement. And that's the thing. The referee usually comes on the microphone and says, oh, so-and-so is an eligible receiver. But clearly what happened here is Taylor Decker walks up to him, and he assumed that it was still Dan Skipper. He assumed that he didn't look at the number and just thought, so once again, Dan Skipper, number 70, coming up to report as eligible, rather than Taylor Decker, number 68, and that threw the whole play to hell in a handbasket. That really screwed the Lions over. Now, they did have two more chances at it, in which on the first try, it was an interception that was called back due to a penalty on the Cowboys. Then on the next try, Goff throws an incompletion before the goal line. But that totally screwed the Detroit Lions over. That took their chance of winning this game. And well, they had this win. They had pulled off the upset in Dallas. But the officials, once again, screwed this up. And what I don't get is why, when coaches screw up, we hold them accountable. When players screw up, we hold them accountable. They get fines. They get suspensions. It's publicly made known to all of us what is going to be done to hold Brad Allen and his crew accountable. I'm not saying someone has to be fired here, but you should make it publicly known what kind of repercussions, what kind of penalties, what kind of suspensions, punishments, fines, something along that line make it known to the public. Don't just have this report come out that Brad Allen and his crew are going to be downgraded. Let us know that they are not going to be part of the NFL postseason. Let us know that they're going to get an excessive fine, that their group is going to be truly held accountable for this. Because it's clear and obvious that they screwed this up. And you look at how this impacts almost everything. This affects everything going forward for the NFL postseason. The Lions still had a chance going into Saturday night to be the one seed in the NFC. Now, it was going to take some help with the 49ers losing at least one time and the Lions winning out. But the Lions win there. You look at a Week 18 game against the Minnesota Vikings, where the Vikings are just a mess at quarterback right now. They don't know who to run out there. All of these guys are screwing up for them. Whereas the 49ers would still have to play all of their guys, possibly play a banged-up, hurt Christian McCaffrey against the Rams, who the Rams have just been one of the hottest teams in the NFL in recent months, winning six of the last seven games after just squeaking by the New York Giants this past weekend. Add to this the other impact that this has as far as the playoffs are concerned. Because I, like many people out there, consider the Dallas Cowboys a bunch of frauds. We've seen how they are at home, how they've beaten up on people, they've been true front runners, whereas on the road, they've been mid at best. They've been an under 500 type team, and really haven't beaten anyone to any significance, including getting their ass handed to them by the San Francisco 49ers, a team that has been their kryptonite in recent years. Well, now, because of this, it puts the Cowboys in the driver's seat to not only win the NFC East, but be the two seed in the NFC, have home field advantage through the first two rounds of the playoffs, and avoid the 49ers until the NFC Championship game. You've impacted so much here. You've affected so much by this call. And these referees, Allen and his crew, need to be punished in some kind of way. As I said, I don't want to see them get fired, but they need to be reprimanded and let it known publicly. It goes to another thing here with Roger Goodell and the NFL owners. Why aren't these guys full-time employees with the league? You have so much money. You're making money hand over fist with all of the tickets you sell, concessions, games that you're putting on streaming services, so what kind of greedy, power-hungry pigs that you are putting regular season games in prime time on streaming services like Amazon Prime and Peacock, putting a playoff game in the first weekend of the postseason on a Saturday night on Peacock, making people go above their means to watch a postseason game. And you can't even have these officials as full-time employees. Like, come on, they should be working year-round on their craft, not from August to February. They need to be full-time. Now, what happened on Saturday night, it's going to allow the 49ers to essentially have a bye week in Week 18. Christian McCaffrey was really banged up against the Commanders. You saw guys like Armstead not playing for the 49ers in Week 17. Now they get to rest and relax. There'll be some guys that maybe got to tune up, maybe play the first drive or two in the first quarter. but they're not going to go all out against the Rams. They're not going to try to win at all costs because they have everything locked up. The division, the first round, bye, home field advantage throughout the postseason. So they're sitting pretty good. With the Rams being in the postseason now, it's a glorified scrimmage. And on top of it, like what I said, the Cowboys are now in the driver's seat to win the NFC East. Some of that by their own doing, some of it based on the fact that the Philadelphia Eagles cannot get out of their own way. The fact that the Philadelphia Eagles continue to just throw up on themselves left and right. Here we have a team that was 10-1 to start the season. And watching them, you could see that they clearly were not as dominant as last year's Philadelphia Eagles team. But they were still the defending NFC champions. They were still a team that you have to respect, a team that could go to the Super Bowl. Well, how can you have any faith in them after losing their home finale last Sunday to the Arizona Cardinals, who have nothing to play for? A Cardinals team that most of their fan base want them to lose to get a better draft position. You're leading 21-6 at halftime at home to a team that is 3-12, and you lose the game. You let Kyler Murray, who struggled in the first half, come out there and blitz you in the second half, lead 4 consecutive scoring drives. And on top of that, the Eagles can't run the football. You have stupid penalties like Kaylee Ringo getting flagged for a pass interference penalty that extended the Cardinals' final drive, allowed them to take the lead in the closing minutes of this game. And your defense, you know, we brag about this defensive line, talking about how great it is. Your defense gave up 450 yards to that team. You couldn't stop a nosebleed. They ran it straight down your throat all game long. James Conner and Michael Carter were making big plays against you guys. It was just an embarrassing crap show showing. With what's going on with the Jets and Giants already being long eliminated from postseason contention, you were hoping that there was going to be some form of playoffs being played in this area, some form of home field advantage played in this area. But right now, all we got to look forward to in the future, whether it be Lincoln Financial Field or MetLife Stadium, is the Rink hosting WrestleMania 40 this coming April, and MetLife Stadium hosting 2 hockey games in mid-February, including when yours truly, along with my dear friend and CSB legend, the great Katie Walsh, attend the Devils Flyers in mid-February. There's not much to look forward to at those 2 respective stadiums in the coming months, now because of the Eagles throwing up all over themselves. If they could have just held serve, then maybe I wouldn't be as outraged about the call in the Lions-Cowboys today. Although, I know that my dear friend, my good pal from high school, Billy August, is quite pissed off today by that. And he's got every right to, because the Lions could have made things even easier on themselves, a team that has not had much luck over their history. And instead, now they're going to have to settle for going through a tougher road, rather than having maybe 3 games to win their first Super Bowl in franchise history. Now they're going to have to win 4, including, in all likelihood, facing their old pal, Matthew Stafford, in week 1 of the playoffs. So, great job, NFL officials. You really set things up right here once again. stuff to talk about in this podcast, give you some thoughts on the college football bowl season. A big trade went down in the NBA over the weekend, mixing some more thoughts on Week 17 and how it's going to impact things going into the final week of the NFL regular season. So I got a lot to talk about today. Glad you guys could join me this week. And as I tell you, each and every single week at this time, help, sit back, relax, put your feet up, and continue keeping it sports with M3.
I'll be back.
Their bowl season. Not even joking around here when I say this. If you put together an investment group and put together, say, $5, $6 million, you could get the naming rights for a bowl game and they'll add to it. They won't take away from someone else. No, they'll add to it because every single year they add another one of these stupid, crappy bowl games that no one really watches, that no one really gives a damn about. Take, for example, there was the Pop-Tart Bowl the other day. You had a stupid mascot go into a replica toaster and come out as a giant edible Pop-Tart. That got everyone all laughing and saying, oh, that's funny, that's cute. No, it came off as ridiculous. It came off as annoying. And I don't mean to sound like old man here, but come on. There should be at the most 8 bowl games, not 43, because you're having so much mediocrity, so much average, so much crap being put out there on the field. And I get it. These kids, they fight their ass off all year long. They go through excruciating summer practices that aren't governed and restricted in the same way that they do with practices in the NFL. The 33 bowl games, we really need every team that finished 6-6 or better to be represented in the month of December. And that's another thing here. We have these games taking place a month after the regular season comes to an end. Why so much time? Why so much time? What are you gaining out of that by having these teams wait a month in between game action? Because you watch these games, the quality of football played is not great. It's awful. It takes these kids at least half a quarter, sometimes into the second quarter, to really adjust and get back to football game speed. Sometimes these coaches are coaching hesitant in the first quarter rather than going all out to try and win. They're more afraid of making the mistakes than going out there and getting the victory. And the players, they've realized the nonsense behind it. They've realized the crap fest it is unless they're in the college football playoff. And that, at these 43 bowl games, those three games, the semifinal and finals, are the only three games that matter, that you can truly give a damn about. And the players show it. I know Bo Nix played in the Fiesta Bowl yesterday, but that was really the exception, not the rule, when it comes to these non-playoff bowl games. Jaden Daniels, he opted out. Marvin Harrison Jr., he opted out of the Cotton Bowl last week. And then there was the embarrassment that happened last weekend in the Orange Bowl is that Georgia played a glorified scrimmage. Georgia went out there against Florida State and played a bunch of high school kids. They were playing a bunch of freshmen and sophomores who really had not gotten much burn, who had not gotten much playing time, and handed it to them. Then you see that over two dozen players from Florida State couldn't play either because of injuries or they chose to opt out or transfer out of their disgust for not making the college football playoff, not being given a chance to compete for a championship by the committee after an undefeated season, a season that I think is even more impressive, the fact that they had to go through so much adversity with playing multiple quarterbacks, including losing Jordan Travis late in the season to a broken leg and still coming away as conference champions. But that was not the same Florida State team that we watched all year. You look, they were without players who were responsible for 97% of their passing yards, 88% of their rushing yards, and 84% of their receptions. Hey, even Kirby Smart was apologetic at the end of the game press conference saying that, oh, we didn't play the real Florida State Seminoles. He realizes what a crap fest it was, and anybody who watched it realized what a waste of time it was. The only games that mattered were the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl yesterday. And thankfully, with those, we got two classics. We got two epic endings to those games. Yeah, they were sloppy at times. Yeah, they had you scratching your head. If you're a Michigan fan today, you're saying, thank God we won. Because there would have been a lot of questioning Harbaugh as far as decisions. There would have been a lot of blame, especially on the special teams. Hell, the special teams coordinator at Michigan probably would have been run out of town. They would have been chasing him out of Ann Arbor with pitchforks and living pieces of wood with how bad their special teams were with the constant fumbles, the missed field goal late in the game. Hell, James Burnup would have been enemy number one, especially with that second fumble with about a minute to go in regulation. You watch him, he calls for the fair catch, botches it, and then recovers it at the 1 yard line and has the sensibility to fall to a knee, deadening the ball without being pushed backwards into the end zone or going back into the end zone on his own momentum. Because if he goes back in the end zone on his own momentum after fumbling the ball like that, that's not a touchback. That would have been ruled a safety in that spot. And you had, what, three or four Alabama guys right up on him? But I give Michigan a lot of credit. The fact that late in the game, when they realized the ground game wasn't working in the second half, they weren't winning a lot of the battles at the line of scrimmage, they let J.J. McCarthy throw the ball down the field. You're down by a touchdown late in the game. You can't be stubborn. You can't just say, oh, our ground game worked all year long. It will work here now. Michigan was not running the ball to the same effectiveness. Alabama was making them work for their yardage. And you finally got that one drive where you were able to air it out against Alabama and tie this game up with a couple minutes ago. The guts by Harbaugh, because a lot of coaches in that spot on that fourth down with about 3 minutes to go, three timeouts, they would punt the football. They would say, all right, my defense has been playing well. We'll hold them here and try to take one last shot at the end of the game. Harbaugh's like, that last shot may not come available to us. That last shot may not be there for the taking. So we're going to take it right here, right now. And he completes the pass to Blake Corum, sets up the game-tying drive at the end. I thought maybe they'd go for two, but discretion was the better part of valor there. And they come away with the victory in overtime. I know college football's overtime is biggest load of crap in the world, how they play it and essentially take special teams out of the mix here. But what had been ailing Alabama all game long finally came back to bite them. I don't think it was just we're calling a quarterback run up the middle. We're going to have Jalen Milroe try to dive through the defensive line of Michigan, dive through their front seven. No, I think that play just broke down based on the awful snaps that were going on throughout this game. There was a horrible center-to-quarterback exchange all throughout this that Alabama, as much as I dislike how much Nick Saban whines and complains at times, they're right. They let that game get away from them. Michigan had periods of time through this game where they weren't able to move the football effectively, where they're making stops defensively, but their offense is giving them nothing. There were chances to be taken there by Alabama, but too many botched snaps in the end came back to bite them. And when you're getting pressure on your quarterback like that throughout the game and continuously having poor snaps, it's going to come back and get you at some point. Your weaknesses when you're going up against bad teams maybe don't come to the forefront. But in college football playoff, but when there's nothing but top-tier teams, it's going to come back and get you big time. Now, the second half of the doubleheader, the Sugar Bowl, let's face it, this should not have been as competitive at the end as it turned out to be. Michael Penix Jr. was awesome. Michael Penix Jr. lit up this Longhorns defense all throughout the game. But I thought in the fourth quarter, when Washington had seemingly had control of this game all night, were seemingly two scores ahead of Texas throughout most of this second half, and Texas had no life to them, they started to let their foot off the gas. They started to get cute, started too many trickeration plays, too many gadget plays. I think in some ways it pissed Texas off, saying, wait a minute, this is still, 13, 14 minutes to go in this game? You're only up by 13 points, and you're going to try and get cute with us now? You're going to start all these flea flickers, all these gadget plays, try to embarrass us like that? No. That lit a fire under Quinn Evers. That lit a fire under this Longhorns offense that had been somewhat dormant throughout most of this game. And you look at some of these last couple of drives for Texas, maybe you want to say it was a bad defense by Washington, but there were some clutch plays here. There were some plays where you look at Quinn Evers and you say, nope, he comes back next year. That's going to be a guy that's a favorite for the Heisman because he showed a lot of guts. He showed a lot of moxie with some of the shots that he was willing to take down the field and got them within one score in the final moments of this game. Got them where everybody sits there as a child dreaming about that moment on a football field where they have a chance to just win it at the buzzer. And he had that spot handed right to them. Now, some of it was just bad luck by Washington. Some of it was stupidity. I don't care why on their second to last drive, third and goal with 2:40 left on the clock, they're having Penix back up and throw the football. Run the ball, forced Texas to use one of its final two timeouts. That gave Texas more time, gave them more chances to stay in this. And then just the ultimate bad luck spot where Dylan Johnson goes down with an injury before the fourth down, before you're ready to put the football away. This isn't like the NFL where you get the injured guy off the field and you have the clock continue to roll. College football, they stop the clock there and it doesn't continue until the next play is started. So Texas got bailed out there a little bit because originally there probably would have been about 15 seconds left on the game clock there if Dylan Johnson was able to get off the field on his own. But you stop the clock. Texas with no timeouts left. They had about 40, 41, 42 seconds left once they got the ball to come down the field. And Evers made two big plays, one to Jordan Winnington, one to Jaden Blow, to set them up with good field position, but give Elijah Johnson a lot of credit. The swat there at the end to stop Mitchell from scoring the go-ahead touchdown. Big play, big moment in that game. And now we get a national championship game next Monday night between two undefeated teams, Michigan and Washington. What's better than that? One goes away as champion. One has a disappointing first loss in the season. And a lot is going to be decided about the future of Jim Harbaugh here. He wins this, all likelihood he leaves for the NFL. A lot is going to be decided on the futures here for Michael Penix and J.J. McCarthy. We know both of these guys are in all likelihood going to be going out in this year's draft. One last chance to impress for NFL teams that could look at them as their future quarterbacks. So I'm excited for this. I'm really jacked up for this game. A winner-take-all game next Monday night at RNG Stadium in Houston.
I'll be back.
Sometimes being annoying with his upbeat personality, his always positive mindset, and he seems like one of those guys that just never gets pissed off about anything. But I also love his play on the football field, love what I saw from him when he was a Seattle Seahawk. I have liked what I've seen from him at times this year with the Denver Broncos. Thought it has been a good bounce back year for him with the Broncos, getting them back into playoff contention after what was an awful start to this season where they look like a complete mess. They really started to be competitive, got on a bit of a winning streak, and up until this week were in contention for a playoff spot. So it outright disgusts me, the crap that he is now going through when it comes to the, I guess you want to call it a war that has developed between him and his head coach, Sean Payton. When last Wednesday, Sean Payton informed all of us that Russell Wilson is getting benched, will serve now as the backup quarterback for the rest of the season to Jared Stidham. Jared Stidham, who has never accomplished a thing in this league, has always been that what-if guy, that guy that scouts fall in love with when it comes to his arm, but has never really taken the brass ring when he's had opportunities to start and ran with it. And you're benching Russell Wilson because of the excuse was the, quote, the number one push behind this, and it's the decision I'm making, is to get a spark offensively. But it's not like the Broncos were last in the league and everything. They were averaging about 22 points a game with Wilson as their quarterback. Yes, they were not a great third down team. We're not good in goal-to-go situations. But Wilson was 6th in the league with touchdowns scored, 18th in passing yards, and outside of that one game against the Miami Dolphins, he had been fine. He had played well. You know what this is? This is the result of the fact that the Broncos are realizing, we screwed up with some of the terminology in the contract extension we gave Wilson before he even played a drive for us. See, when Russell Wilson got traded from the Seahawks to the Broncos, he still had 2 years remaining on his contract. But the Broncos hierarchy at that time decided to get aggressive. They decided that this is our guy now and in the future, being that he's still at a relatively young age in his early 30s. He's someone that we can win with now and in the future. Gave him a 5-year, $242.6 million contract extension. And have backed themselves into a corner with that because, well, his deal is already guaranteed through the first couple of years of this contract. He's guaranteed to make $39 million in 2024. He can make an additional $37 million if he cannot pass a physical by early March before the start of the new league year. They could say all they want, oh, this is offensively driven. You're not benching Russell Wilson for Jared Stidham to improve your offense. You're benching him because you want to save money, and quite frankly, your head coach, Sean Payton, has acted like a jackass since he got to Denver. First, he wanted to defend Russell Wilson when it came to the Nathaniel Hackett situation last year, seemingly wanted to put all of what happened last year in Nathaniel Hackett's lap. Then he flipped it around and just tried to make Russ 1 of 53. When we know that this guy is a Super Bowl champion, is a guy that at times has been a contender for league MVP. But Sean Payton, after a year away from coaching, wanted to come in and just put his stamp on everything. I don't see you doing that with Drew Brees in New Orleans, where Drew Brees was out there shaking hands, kissing babies, was essentially the mayor of New Orleans, but now you're trying to stop him from being that guy for you? Sean Payton, you've been an embarrassment this year off the field. You've been an embarrassment as a person and a head coach for this team. The only thing that is saving you right now is A, that long-term contract you signed with the Broncos, B, the fact that you've accomplished something in this league as a head coach elsewhere, unlike Nathaniel Hackett, and C, the fact that the Broncos ownership would have total egg on their face if they decided to fire a head coach in the first year of their deal for the second year in a row. The way you're treating Russell Wilson, the disrespect you're showing that man is complete garbage. He has earned better than that. He has earned your respect. You have not accomplished so much in this league where you can just look down on him like he's the equivalent of everyone else on the roster. That's why, even though they won on Sunday against the Chargers, and I so badly wanted the AFC West to still be on the line, make the Chiefs feel some pressure in Week 18, I'm kind of glad that they defeated the Bengals. I'm kind of glad that they won the division. Knocking the Broncos out of contention, knocking them out from being alive for the postseason once again, so that Sean Payton can just sit there on his rear end once this season is over, look himself in the mirror, hopefully, and realize, I gotta change, because I'm the piece of garbage in the room, not everyone else. The Chiefs, as I said, did clinch the AFC West over this weekend against a Bengals squad that becomes the first amongst the four teams in the AFC North to be eliminated from postseason contention. They put up a fight after losing Joe Barrett for the season, but eventually it became too much. We're not able to hold serve at the end. You still have three teams from that division alive for the postseason heading into Week 18. Two of them have clinched their spot with the Browns railroading my Jets last week. What an embarrassing performance that was. I mean, Joe Flacco just rolls in off the couch and has been excellent for them. A team that has started four different players at quarterback this year, has had myriads of injuries on the offensive line, down to their fourth and fifth tackles in some spots. Well, without Amari Cooper, lose Elijah Moore to a potential concussion, and you hope with the way he was twitching on the field that that was the worst of it, and still make the postseason. Give Kevin Stefanski and that coaching staff a lot of credit, how they've been able to hold things together through so much adversity and get 11 wins out of this team with the challenges at quarterback, challenges on the offensive line, the fact that Myles Garrett had not had a sack in over a month and still pulled this off, very impressive. And the only thing that stops them from winning this division is the dominance of the Baltimore Ravens. A Baltimore Ravens squad that went and played the Miami Dolphins this week and showed what kind of frauds the Miami Dolphins are. Yeah, I know Miami was missing some people. They were without Jalen Waddle. They were without Raheem Mostert. But after an early 10-7 lead, they collapsed. They were making mistakes. Tua throwing interceptions that gave the Ravens life, that gave the Ravens defense a chance to just pin its ears back and absolutely destroy what was bragged about as a high-power offense of the Miami Dolphins. But the Dolphins have continued to be frauds. The Dolphins have continued to show us they can't beat anybody unless it's in South Florida, and they can't beat good teams. They've, what, one win against a team with a winning record this year, and that was a Cowboys team that can't win games on the road. And Lamar Jackson, that had to have been the deal breaker for him. That had to be the one that locked up league MVP for him. He had more passing touchdowns than he had incompletions in this game. He had a perfect passing rating in the first half. Now when you look at this LFC North, the Browns are going to be able to somewhat relax. They're going to kind of, even though they don't have a bye, they're going to treat Week 18 against the Bengals as a bye because they've locked up the fifth seed in the AFC and can rest some guys after the first quarter, not get them banged up too much. The Ravens can do the same thing. They'll maybe play Lamar Jackson and company for a quarter. They're not going to be playing all out to try and win this. They're not going to be playing all out. They're going to be going up against a Steelers team that I got to be nice about. I got to talk nice things and say good things about, as I promised one of my work sons, Steven, who's a supposedly big-time Steelers fan, although he comes off as kind of a fraud because he bet money on the Seattle Seahawks this past weekend against the Pittsburgh Steelers. But the Pittsburgh Steelers are what we should all strive for when it comes to the team that we root for, in not just football, but all of professional sports. Because, no, they don't have the most Super Bowls of all time anymore. That's been both tied and passed since the days of the Steel Curtain. They still have six titles, but it's been tied up by teams like the New England Patriots. But this organization is the model of consistency. This organization is a franchise that has gone 20 years without a losing season, and 16 consecutive with Mike Tomlin as their head coach. That's why, for as much crap as Terry Bradshaw gives him on the Fox broadcast, for as much as certain Pittsburgh Steelers fans want to bitch, moan, whine, cry, and complain about some of his coaching decisions at the end of the games or during the year, this is one of the great coaches of our lifetime. No, he does not have the resume of Bill Belichick, but look at it. The quarterback position for the Steelers for the last couple of years has been a mess, dating back to an old, fat, decrepit Ben Roethlisberger in his final few seasons. And look at some of the other people that he's had to deal with. Kenny Pickett, who's been aight. Going with Mitchell Trubisky, who was one of the wastes of a first-round draft pick of all time by the Bears. And Mason Rudolph, who we've seen have good performances, but be mostly crap. And he still has managed to get winning seasons out of this team. He is still, even at times when a couple of years ago they lost T.J. Watt to a pec injury, even at times where offensively they've been extremely challenged and he was too stubborn to fire their offensive coordinator, they have still remained in the hunt. They have still remained alive. Each week finds a way to make it work, including last week. They take advantage of what is the clear weakness of the Seattle Seahawks, their run defense, and ran for over 200 yards right down their throat. Najee Harris, best game of his season, maybe could argue best game of his career. He was that excellent. Hell, they're getting Garrett Wilson-like performances out of Pickens now. And all of that because of the motivation and leadership of the great Mike Tomlin, keeping this ship steady, keeping things afloat no matter how bad things are getting, no matter how inconsistent or below average their quarterback play is. He has kept them alive. They're going to win against the Ravens on Saturday. They're going to be in the postseason, but they're going to need some help. They're going to need some help getting in there. As we sit here today, they are in the ninth spot in the AFC. But where they luck out is the Texans and the Colts play each other. At best, those teams can tie each other. You can't have both teams winning in Week 18. You also have the Buffalo Bills going up against the Miami Dolphins, or as I look at it, the corpse of the Miami Dolphins. So there is still mathematically the chance for the Steelers to make the postseason. We'll see if they do get the help that they need to make the playoffs, but that AFC South is something to watch in Week 18, because you have a three-way tie there where the Jaguars own the tiebreaker. And let's face it, this division should be long over, but you've had injuries with Trevor Lawrence. You've had inconsistent play. They just ended a four-game losing streak this past week. And they could have locked this up a month ago. They could have been challenging the Ravens for the one seed in the AFC, but had it gone on this slide, gave the Colts, who I don't even understand how they win games behind Gardner Minshew and that uneventful, unimpactful offense that they run there. They've allowed the Colts and the Texans, even with Stroud missing the last couple of weeks due to concussion symptoms, allowed them both to remain alive. And now those two teams are playing in a win-and-you're-in playoff scenario on Saturday evening, where the winner would need the Jaguars to lose on Sunday in order to win the AFC South. So you got the AFC South on the line. You've got the AFC East on the line on Sunday Night Football, where the Miami Dolphins look like a decrepit, crippled team right now. And you're getting waxed. You're getting smoked by the Ravens, down by 30 in the late stages in the fourth quarter. And Bradley Chubb is still on the field. He tears his ACL, and now you're without him. You're without Jalen Reagor. In all likelihood, you're going to be without Xavier Howard. That defense is a mess. They've been the walking wounded on offense. And Tua hasn't always been the greatest in big games in his NFL career. Combine that with the fact that the Buffalo Bills have been one of the hottest teams in the league over the last month. It does not look good for Miami and their prospects of winning that division. You have two wild card spots in the AFC on the line, the AFC South on the line, and the NFC South will be decided in Week 18, as well as one final playoff spot in the wild card, whether that be the runner-up in the NFC South. Not likely. I think it's going to have to be one of those scenarios where you win the division or you're out, or either the Packers or Seahawks. But, hey, this is what we like at this time of year. A lot to watch in the later stages of the season, even if your team is not in the mix.
I'll be back.
Line like a Giannis Antetokounmpo or a Joel Embiid or a Jason Tatum, like the top three seeds in the East have, or the top dogs in the West have, but a lot of really good players. You have probably the greatest bargain in all of New York sports in Jalen Brunson. Julius Randle has grown up before our eyes. Stop acting like such a big baby all the time. A lot of talent on that Knicks team, but there were some decisions that you're going to have to make here. Because R.J. Barrett, where you like him as a player, inconsistent. And sometimes him and Randall being on the floor at the same time, it takes Barrett completely out of the offense, and he looks like a lost player out there. Doesn't look like a guy that gave $100 million to a little over a year ago. You have a youngster in Emmanuel Quickley, who is instant offense off the bench, one of the lead contenders for the sixth man of the year the last couple of years, and one of the top scoring guards off the bench in the league. But he's quickly coming up on free agency, and you don't want to lose him for nothing. Well, you finally pushed some of those assets to the middle of the table, traded Barrett quickly and a second-round draft pick to the Raptors the other day to get three players, most notably OG Anunoby. And while Knick fans are complaining on social media, this is a move that improves. Do I think Anunoby is that much of an offensive upgrade over R.J. Barrett? No, I think they're about the same. But Anunoby is one of the top perimeter defensive players in the league. He averages almost two steals a game over the last 2 years. That's good for third in the NBA. He's ranked second in defensive half-court matchups against All-Stars a year ago, only trailing Brooklyn's Mikal Bridges. This is a guy that has been in the league since 2017, and you've seen slowly but surely grow before your eyes as not just a good defensive player, but an all-around good player. Maybe not a star, maybe not, like I said, that guy that takes you across the finish line, but he is an upgrade over R.J. Barrett. He's what you hoped R.J. Barrett would turn into as an all-around player. And it doesn't cost you, for now, as much against the salary cap. Now, he is an impending free agent, and you're going to have to spend money on him to keep him beyond this season. But the Raptors realize at 12-19, coming off of being that team that finally lost to the Detroit Pistons over the weekend, it was time to make moves. It was trying to shake things up. They're expected to possibly move Pascal Siakam in the next couple of weeks. They're looking at potentially a full-on rebuild, whereas the Knicks, although before yesterday they were on a three-game losing streak, they are a team that should be better than 8th in the Eastern Conference. They are a team that is going to be looking to make impactful moves in the next couple of weeks, because this is not it. This is not the only move the Knicks are going to make between now and the trade deadline. We've talked about before, between this year and, 2029, they have something like 9 or 10 first-round draft picks available for them to use. And they're not going to be selecting all of those players. They're going to use them as draft assets to get that big-time player. And I don't know who that player is. The rumors have started up once again about possibly Donovan Mitchell coming to New York. That could definitely be an option. Or if things really start to fall apart in Phoenix, would the Suns ever consider a full-on rebuild and trading Devin Booker? That's an option there. But you definitely need that dude. You need that guy. Because the Knicks are good right now. They have a very good roster, albeit lacking some size with losing Mitchell Robinson for the year. But this is a team that is in a win-now mode, a win-now scenario. They got a player that I think Tibbs should like because he's a defensive specialist that can score a little bit. But you need that next piece, that piece that takes you over the top and makes you a true threat to come out of the Eastern Conference, and a team that Boston, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee may say publicly that they're not looking past. But in their minds, they're like, damn, the Knicks, that's something that we're going to have to deal with this year and for some years to come if we want to come out of the Eastern Conference. Now, while moves are being made in the NBA, Major League Baseball, I think, is going to finally start to wake up from its off-season malaise, because it almost felt like this offseason has been kind of put on pause. First, it was Juan Soto. Then, days after that, we had Shohei Ohtani make his decision. And then free agency was being on held until we found out where Yamamoto was going to sign. Well, those guys are off the board now. And with us getting past the holiday season, maybe you'll start to see more rapid movement. Maybe you'll start to see more guys either making free agent decisions or trades to be made. We know that there's starting pitchers that could potentially be available. The likes of Corbin Burns and Dylan Cease have been mentioned as trade candidates. But on paper, we saw a big name get moved over the weekend in Chris Sale. A move for the Atlanta Braves, where you're looking and saying, all right, we have a surplus of young players here. Vaughn Grissom is essentially on the outside looking in with us making the trade for Kalinic and not having a spot for him to get every day at bats in the big leagues. He has proven already he is too good for the minor leagues, and we want to win now. But you're not bringing in Chris Sale to be your ace. He's no longer that guy. He's 34 years old. It's been 5 years since he's given you 30-plus starts in a season. Hell, this past year was looked at as a renaissance by him, and he only threw 102 innings at the tune of a 4 ERA. He's been average at best when he's been on the field, and his durability has come into question a lot the last several years. He was out all of 2020 and most of 2021 recovering from Tommy John, had rib injuries that delayed him in 2022, and had his pinky broken in his first start back that ended his season that year. So it's been a long time since you've gotten a full body of work out of Chris Sale. What the Braves are hoping is that he can come in. He's got 1 year left on his deal. It's kind of a buy-low scenario. Be a quality fourth starter behind Spencer Strider, Max Fried, and Charlie Morton. And you take whatever you get out of him. Hope that if he doesn't fill the bill, that he can at least get you to a point where you possibly call up your top prospect, A.J. Smith Schiller. You still have Ian Anderson there. You have Bryce Elder that was a free agent there. So there's plenty of options there. But that move for Chris Sale is not the move that's going to put you over the top. This really hasn't been the move as far as pitching after Ohtani and Yamamoto that's going to put anyone over the top. In fact, I'm looking at these teams, I'm like, what the hell is going on in baseball's free agency? The fact that Lucas Giolito is getting 2 years, $38 million, a guy that got off to a good start with the White Sox last year in his walk year, and then totally collapsed with the Angels to the point where they DFA'd him. He goes to Cleveland and was batting practice for the Guardians. He's getting $18 to $19 million per season. He should be looking up to the sky saying, thank you, God, thanking his agent for putting together such a great deal for him, being such a great negotiator. And the even more questionable one is Frankie Montas. What the hell are the Reds doing giving this guy $16 million? He pitched in only one game last year after having shoulder surgery. He was complete garbage for the Yankees in the 8 starts over the final 2 months of the season in 2022 for them. And when he was in Oakland, he had a mid-2 ERA pitching in that depth of the ballpark, but was batting practice in mostly everywhere else. He's going now to the Great American Small Park, as we call it, joining a Reds team that was 25th in the league in ERA last season. I know they've got some fun, young, exciting players on that team, but that's not an upgrade of any means for your rotation. And to give him $16 million, I have no idea what the Reds are thinking. I have no idea what the Red Sox are thinking. Just because, they got Chris Sale off the books, now they're going to throw stupid money at Giolito? These guys like Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery that are still sitting out there as free agents, they're still sitting out there as free agents thinking to themselves, wow, those guys pitched like crap and they got $16 to $19 million. Jordan Montgomery was awesome for the Rangers in the postseason, helping them win the World Series. Blake Snell is a 2-time Cy Young winner, so they're just sitting back and they're hoping that someone out there is of the same mindset of them and saying, those guys got $16 to $19 million, I deserve $25 million with the way that I've pitched. And in their cases, they are right. But you hope that there is going to start to be some movement here. Both teams in New York, need to make some upgrades in their starting rotation. There's plenty of quality players, both pitching and offensively, led by Cody Bellinger, available that can make an impact. And we're only, what, about 6 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting for spring training. So hopefully, over the next week or so, we're going to start to see
to go. Good night, everybody. I have had enough of you. Thank you for all the fun. Thank you. Hey, shut up, will ya?
I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear you. I don't want to smell you. Now leave.
I'll be back.